This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. 6 months after police dismantled a controversial homeless encampment in Daytona Beach, community leaders are still wrangling over where to build a permanent shelter. One of the voices calling for answers is Father Phil Egito. He's the pastor at Our Lady of Lourdes in Daytona Beach. He's part of an organization called Fighting Against Injustice Towards Harmony or Faith. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So the city is now paying to temporarily house homeless in motels after moving them out of an emergency shelter run by the Salvation Army. Father Phil, I wonder if you could give us a quick background of what's led to this.
Okay, well, basically, after the, as you put it, the encampment happened, the city basically found an emergency solution to the homeless problem, which was to make a contract with Salvation Army. Salvation Army gave them originally 90 days and then 90 days more. However, Salvation Army said, your 180 days are up. And so what happened then was the city, I think compassionately, I don't want to make them all sound bad, said, well, let's give the people that were in this program at the Salvation Army, I believe there were 86 people, a chance to get themselves situated. So I believe it ends this week, but they gave them, from what I understand, 11 days at a hotel, in a motel in Daytona Beach. And it gave the people an opportunity to figure out where they want to go, what they're going to do. Some of them maybe have opportunities to go with family, to go wherever. Some of them are going to go back on the street. The city obviously can't afford to constantly have hotel rooms. But the issue really isn't an emergency solution. The issue needs to be a permanent solution. And so that's why we've been advocating for a homeless shelter. I've been working on this for the past 5 years. And we certainly see it as a county problem and not just a Daytona Beach problem.
Why is it so hard for city, county, other community leaders to decide where to build this permanent shelter?
Well, actually, it's not that hard to decide because between what is the best location, we've done a lot of research as to where would be centrally located, have transportation with the bus system. And we found a location that's actually ideal in that it is located by the jail, because a lot of times people get out of jail with nowhere to go. It is also by Stuart Marchman Act, which is a major hour only, really, a place for people to receive mental health services and drug and alcohol rehabilitation. So it's actually on property that is on the west side of town. It's not really in anybody's backyard because the political will when it's in your backyard is a lot of issues. So we really did find an ideal location. And the county has property there. And at one point in all this work, the county was willing to give the city the property. However, when they did that, there were a lot of strings attached and the city wouldn't accept the strings that were attached. It's very frustrating to watch government in action and inability to accomplish anything because it sounded great. We're going to give you the land. I'm going to give you $4 million for a building. And then they had to fight who's going to own the building, who's not going to own the building. What happens if the homeless shelter doesn't work? Who's going to get the building after that? What happens if it's used for something? A lot of crazy. It should be relatively simple. We need a homeless shelter. If the county wants to build it, fine. We have, I think, 16 cities, many of which I have solicited, and they are willing to contribute to the ongoing operating budget. We also have engaged Catholic Charities from Orlando, who is really willing to do whatever the county and the city want them to do. And working with them, their hopes is that in 5 years, they won't need any county money or city money, government money at all. They need to start. They need a building. We need a place. But they're willing to take this on. So I don't understand really what is so difficult for the county and the city to make this happen. It needs to happen.
The Daytona Beach News Journal reported some $700,000 spent in the last few years on this issue and not much to show for it. Do you have a sense of where that money's gone?
Well, according to the city manager last week, he said between donations and what the city gave up, they've spent $500,000, close to $500,000. Well, just because they used the Salvation Army, it wasn't free. I believe they paid $20 a night per person, and I believe there were 86 people there. So just because Salvation Army wasn't involved didn't mean it didn't cost the city anything. And so we are also very much supportive of Housing First model. You see, most communities have a shelter already, which enables the federal funded Housing First to really take root, we don't have emergency shelter. And so there's no place for people to wait before they can get into rapid rehousing or housing first. Certainly, we want our shelter not to be jail-like. We certainly want it to be empathetic and supportive to help people feel a sense of dignity, because that works best. Yet we don't have an abundance of apartments to put people in tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. So you've been working on this issue for 5 years. Did Daytona Beach have a shelter before that?
No. Salvation Army had – no. I think they had 18 beds, and I could fill that on any given weekend. As a church, and I'm sure other churches as well, people come to us and say, you know, Father, we just got kicked out. Father, we are traveling and we have no more money. Father, we have this, we have that. And I've had to personally, actually, or my church has put people into hotels just for one night or two nights. I don't have an endless supply of resources either. And I don't also have the time to do case management to say, okay, well, let's find out, do you have family we can contact, or do you get SSI? Do you get disability? It takes several hours of case management to actually find solutions. You'd be amazed that sometimes people have disability checks, yet they have no address for them to be able to cash them. Mm-hmm. You may find that two people have disability checks and together you combine them, they can afford an apartment, but by themselves they can't. So case management is an integral part of what needs to be done. And it's always been part of our plan for an emergency shelter that they would get, come as you are, 24 hours, 7 days a week, and they would be in the first 24 hours, get a case manager to look at their situation to see what solutions can come up with. And a lot of times it's not as hard as it all sounds, mm-hmm. but we need case management.
Is there a city or somewhere you're looking at which has a shelter that Daytona Beach would like to model its shelter on?
We're kind of unique, but there are many cities that have we've been looking at. Miami has the name slips my mind, but they have a fabulous shelter that's very inclusive. And we've looked at them as models. We've looked at Gainesville has a great shelter. I think, you know, Pinellas Safe Harbor is a jail diversionary shelter, which does do certain things. It's more compassionate to be in a shelter than to be in jail. Mm-hmm. So when people say, well, jail diversion is not very compassionate, well, go live on the street for a week and see if a shelter is more compassionate than being in jail and then getting an arrest record, which makes it hard to get a job, which mm-hmm. makes life even more difficult. So we have looked at many different cities, and yet, you know, Volusia County is kind of unique the way it's set up between the east side and the west side and, you know, north and south with a big divide in between the two, between DeLand and Daytona. So we basically found a great location that has bus service to DeLand and bus service to Daytona on the hour. I'm from Brooklyn, so service on the hour is a good thing.
What about Daytona Beach itself? I mean, do you think there's something about the city which makes its homeless population different or unique compared to other cities in Central Florida?
Well, I wouldn't say different than Central Florida. I think Florida has a unique situation because as we get snowbirds who aren't homeless, we get snowbirds who are homeless because of our climate being more livable in the winter months. So I don't think it's that different, but I do think we're different than Orlando, which is a huge city. Well, Winter Park, Winter Springs, all these little cities make up a very huge city. Daytona is relatively small, and yet because when you talk about people know where Daytona Beach is. You know, you may not know where Winter Springs is or Castleberry, but you know where Orlando is. In the same way, Daytona is like the Orlando of Volusia County, but it's not. It's tiny, tiny, tiny. And so we have big city problems, but we are really a much smaller city.
Now, the city commission says it's willing to commit $400,000 towards the homeless services. Do you get the sense that that might just get eaten up by paying things like hotel bills, or could that be a down payment on a new shelter?
It definitely can be a down payment on a new shelter. In fact, the city, up until 2 weeks ago, had their own property. And they seem to be moving ahead with using their own property, saying, you know, county, we're going to just do this because we need this. And they were talking about using their own property, which is not as ideal as the county property, but pretty close to it. It's not that far away. It's not that big of a – not that – maybe a half a mile from where we were looking. And so they were moving ahead. And I think if they would just shake hands with Catholic Charities and commit to $400,000 a year and commit to helping, you know, Catholic Charities go to the other cities. I know South Daytona has put money in their budget. I spoke to a city commissioner yesterday for next year. So it's not like the city of Daytona has to flip the entire bill. But no one also has been approached. I mean, certainly Halifax Hospital is willing to put a clinic out at the site, which will save the Halifax Hospital tremendous amounts of money. I am certain we have Florida Hospital there as well, which the Adventists are very generous. And the Adventists recognize the situation. And I am sure if asked, Florida Hospital will also contribute. So a lot of – and our business community will contribute. So I do think the city just needs to take the chance and say, let's make this happen and make it happen. I do believe there are a lot of untapped donations and people willing to give, but I think the city is scared. Mm-hmm. They have an idea – you know, the government and people have this idea of lack, that we're never going to have enough. As a Christian, I believe in a God of abundance. And when you respond to helping our brothers and sisters, you'll be amazed at how much abundance there is that will enable us to help. We can't even begin to imagine the cost to tourism that having homeless people on Beach Street and on Atlantic Avenue is costing the city and costing Volusia County. Whereas if we weren't motivated by compassion for our brothers and sisters sleeping on the street, perhaps we would be motivated by some good business sense, mm-hmm. the health of a community.
Now, you told the Daytona Beach News Journal that you wanted to get the County Council and the City Commission in one room to talk it out before November. How are you going to make that happen?
Well, our organization has an organizer, and so we hire her. Her name is Jessica, and she is really great. And hopefully we have a board meeting Thursday night, and our homeless committee will be talking about how we're going to make that happen. So my hope is that we invite them together and we sit them at table and say, you know, let's hash this out and let's get this moving, because it's been enough.
Father Phil Egito is the pastor at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church in Daytona Beach. We've been discussing the city's homeless and the hopes of some homeless advocates to build a permanent emergency shelter. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, best-selling young adult author Kate DiCamillo has a new novel set at a Central Florida beauty pageant contest. And will a redrawn district give longtime Republican Congressman John Mica a real challenge to hold on to his seat? Also, candidates for competitive county commission races in Orange, Seminole, and Volusia counties are out on the campaign trail. Political commentators Dick Batchelor and Chris Carmody explore what candidates are spending and what's at stake. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Winter Park Republican John Mica has been a member of the U.S. House of Representatives since 1993. But will a redrawn district that includes more of downtown Orlando pose a bigger challenge for Mica? Meanwhile, Election Day is just weeks away for county commissioners in several competitive races in Orange County, and some seats in Volusia and Seminole counties are also drawing stiff competition. Well, joining me in the studio, Chris Carmody, attorney and Republican political analyst. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
And welcome back also former Democratic state lawmaker Dick Batchelor.
And thank you. Good morning.
Let's start with the race for Congressional District 7. This is John Mica's district. Running against Mica is Stephanie Murphy. Dick Batchelor, tell me a bit about Stephanie Murphy. Who is she?
Well, interesting. She came out of the blue of sorts. I mean, she's a professor. She's also an investor. But in the first week, she raised over $104,000, which was really, you know, quite impressive. And the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee said they're going to put $3 million in that race, which surprises me because it's against the incumbent John Mica, who's very strong, been around for a very long time. But she's going to make it – if they put in $3 million, they're going to make it a very interesting race.
Now, she spoke at the Democratic National Convention too, right?
Sure.
So she's kind of a rising star in the party?
She's a rising star. And again, that raised $104,000 in 1 week as a congressional candidate really – so she's got some skin in the game, so that's quite impressive.
Why aren't there more well-known names from the Democratic side lining up to run against John Mica?
Because 95% of incumbents win re-election. He's very well-liked. He's very popular, very well-known, of course. He's been, before he was in the Congress, he was in the state legislature, so he's got many years in public life. And he's known but to get things done. So I don't want to endorse John Mica here and ruining his chances, but he's very well known for getting things done.
Chris Carmody, let me turn to you. What about some weaknesses that Micah have in this particular race? I mean, there's been some redistricting. The boundaries of his district have been redrawn. Does he have kind of across-the-board appeal?
Yes, he does have an across-the-board appeal, but you said it, redistricting. When they put the DCCC put Stephanie in the red to blue program that they have, and that's where they're going to, as Dick mentioned, put a lot of money behind that race to help them because they see these as potential pickups. To Dick's point, though, Congressman Micah has served in various capacities for multiple decades now here in Central Florida. But this new district, I don't think he's been on the ballot in downtown Orlando ever in his life. Now, is he on the front page of downtown Orlando's paper daily, weekly? Sure. So he has high name ID, but there's a lot of folks in that area who have never voted for him. And I think the DCCC probably looked at the numbers and said, maybe we'll give it a shot.
Mm-hmm. What about the demographics, too? Does somebody who's a bit younger and, you know, let's face it, has a different background, her parents, I believe, were refugees from Vietnam, does that give her a bit of an edge here?
Certainly. I mean, when you think of that downtown Orlando area and the fact that the new district means new voters, she is an appealing story, and she's a fresh face. She can easily go anti-incumbent, which plays well with certain demographics. Because she's a fresh face, she doesn't have a voting record. So it's hard to ding her on just being a Rollins College professor and a refugee background. It's actually that probably works in her favor. So she'll be competitive, especially if, to Dick's point, they put $3 million in that race. But she has to get up on TV. She has to be able to do radio, flyers, et cetera. Otherwise, Micah's name ID alone will probably carry him to the finish line.
And one thing we really don't want that this the unknown factor is the Trump factor.
Right.
I mean, down ballot, does he have an effect? Is it good or is it bad? So if she was going to pick a year to run, and particularly if you're going to get $3 million from the DCCC, this is the year to run because the uncertainty about the incumbency. While all incumbents traditionally win re-election by about 95%, if you poll people about the popularity of the Congress, it's at about 7% or 8%. So it could be a disadvantage to the incumbent this year with the mood of the country.
Are you seeing John Micah line himself up with some of the policies that we're hearing from Donald Trump?
I haven't seen the congressman change his positions on anything. Donald Trump is, we don't need to get into the whole how did he get here and how is he the nominee, but he took on quite a few Republican positions as he moved his way through the primary. So if anything, Donald Trump has moved his way towards a lot of these congressional candidates on the Republican side. I haven't heard any comments or commentary, if you will, from Congressman Micah that makes it seem that he's moved towards Donald. Do I know he's embraced? Of course. That is the Republican nominee, and he's hearing from constituents. He's hearing from voters, supporters. So he has endorsed the nominee, and he's behind him. But I haven't heard him change any positions there. But of course, to Dick's point, all this can go one way or the other. You can use Donald against a candidate or you can use him in favor, and he'll probably help him pick up votes. But possibly in downtown Orlando, if you will, with a more moderate or Democratic crowd, he'll probably lose votes there if you tag him to Donald Trump.
How do you think voters see John Micah? Do they see him as an establishment candidate, or do they see him as somebody who runs kind of against the pack sometimes?
It's a good question. I think the voters who've been voting for him view him as their congressman and kind of goes against the grain. He's never been afraid to buck leadership in Washington. He's worked across the aisles. I mean, probably one of his most ardent supporters is the mayor of Orlando, well-known Democrat Buddy Dyer. So that should tell you about his work history. But to a fresh-faced voter, a 24-year congressman, that just screams establishment. So, you know, he's going to have to overcome that some with some of the new voters. But his reputation, I think, will help in that.
If you look at projects in the Orlando area, of course, he was chairman of the House Transportation Committee for a while, and then, of course, ranking member for a long time, still is. The I-4 expansion over the St. John's River was one of his first projects that got done. It had been on a waiting list. He got it expedited. The I-4 expansion that we're looking at now in the next six-year project, the Greater Orlando International Airport Authority, expansion of the airport. I accused him one time of having an edifice complex. He likes to build stuff. So that's kind of where you see him. If you think of John Mack, you don't necessarily think a very controversial philosophical things, really. You really think of public projects.
Mm-hmm. That kind of speaks to connections and being in Washington for a long time, right? And that
right.
kind of goes against the grain of what we're hearing from voters these days.
That's what Chris is saying. I could go either way. It could. This year would be the 1 year that it could hurt you.
Well, let's move on and talk about some of the county commission and council races. And let's head out to the coast, Volusia County. There's a couple of races there, District 4 and District 2. The county chair is also up for re-election. Let me start with District 4. Five candidates here: Linda Borkwin-McIntyre, Roy Johnson, Heather Post, Al Smith, Roland Veer. Dick Batchelor, just turn your mind to this for a moment. We've got a mayor of Holly Hill, a former mayor, rather, mm-hmm. of Holly Hill in there. Pretty competitive race.
From afar, I would think being a former mayor, Roland Veer being the former mayor of Holly Hill, gives him some advantage. But those races are hard to call. But if you look at Al Smith, he's raised over $53,000, which is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And then Heather Post, last report, raised $34,000. So these are competitive. And the other races are like $3,000, $4,000. So based on the monies they've raised, Heather Post and Al Smith are out far by a long shot. So I would just on its face give them the edge right now.
Yeah, a little wrinkle on that one. You have Al Smith, who's a current radio host there. And again, to Dick's point, he's got the fundraising edge. And Heather's a former police officer. She's married to a deputy sheriff in Volusia County. I think they've pulled ahead. Some of the folks I know in the area, that's who they point to, is who they think will win. But five-way race, I mean, those are very hard to predict.
Mm-hmm.
But I would kind of point to those two as the likely winners.
Is that unusual to see that kind of money being spent in Volusia County?
I think that's right on par. I mean, it's not as big of as a county as Orange or Seminole, but those races are competitive and people are very – that place particularly – are very ginned up on politics lately. You've seen a big shift, just like Orange County has gone from red to blue over the last few years. You've seen that county shift to bright red in a lot of ways, and you've seen the populace get involved in these elections. So,
let's move on then and talk about the chair. Jason Davis, he's not shy of controversy. He's been in the headlines a few times. He doesn't have the money behind him, though. What can you tell us about that race?
So 4 years ago, when the chairman was elected, he didn't have a whole lot of money behind him either. In fact, his opponent had done quite a good job of fundraising. So Jason, I know, does not worry about the funds he's raising. But to your point, he's not afraid of controversy. He certainly, if he thinks he's getting wronged by whether it's the party or someone else, he'll say it publicly, and it makes the headline of the Beacon there in town. But there, it's an interesting race. You've got Ormond Beach mayor, retired Hawaiian Tropic executive Ed Kelly, who's, just a fun fact, his son's one of the members of the Florida-Georgia Line band. It's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. You have Mr. Gimbert, who's a self-proclaimed neighborhood guy. And then you have Lapuka, who's Orange City mayor and a former pro football player. So you've got it's a very interesting race. The money leader is Ed Kelly. But again, as I said, Chair Davis, he didn't have a whole lot of money last time, and he relied on his grassroots and the Tea Party, which was big for him. And I think the Tea Party will be ginned up again, as I was saying earlier. That county has seen such a dramatic change from kind of a red county to very much a bright red county. I mean, there's a reason Donald Trump went there just recently, days after Tim Kaine went there, that he knows that's a big area for him to go in. So if Chair Davis can keep his Tea Party roots strong, I think he'll probably be in good shape. But make no mistake, Mayor Kelly and Mayor Lapuka and even Mr. Gimber are going to give him a run there.
Are there some issues, though, which might motivate Democratic voters to go to the polls in Volusia County, like environmental issues, for example? The beach sometimes comes up as a topic of discussion out there.
Sure, and whether you should drive on the beach becomes mm-hmm. up, and everything else. And I think that no doubt both the red and blue voters and those who don't identify with either will show up and vote. I think this election, especially in that county, will draw folks out. You know, I think it is dispositive on who wins? No. I think, you know, they look at the global scheme of things over there and they see that Speedway's doing well lately. So that's generating, you know, economic activity. Tourism numbers are up. But sure, the environmental issues do move the needle for some folks. I think you see Mr. Gimbert try to weigh in on that. He's a self-proclaimed environmentalist as well. But it's tough to say. It didn't seem to matter 4 years ago. Maybe it'll matter more this time.
Mm-hmm. And Greg Gimbert also is the vice chairman of the Soil and Conservation Board. So that probably as environmental credentials, so he'll probably try to move the needle on that. It's interesting, too, if you look at it, you've got the incumbent, you've got the vice chair of the Soil and Conservation Board, you've got a former mayor of Ormond Beach, a former mayor of Orange City, and you've got Ed Kelly, the former mayor of Ormond Beach, sitting on $102,000. And as of last report, Jason Davis, the incumbent's only raised $10,000. Mm-hmm. Chris's point, though, he said he seems to have done very well last time without the money. But that's a substantial amount of money to be spending in a county chair's race in Volusia County.
And just wondering what the Trump factor might be here, too. Of course, you know, talking about the fact that Volusia County seems to have gone, as you say, from red to bright red. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing that? I mean, there was a huge turnout to that rally in Daytona Beach. What are your thoughts there, Dick Batchelor?
I mean, obviously, Trump coming into any community kind of galvanizes that community, particularly the red base, as it were. So will it go up and down the ticket? I get my inclination is where Trump is strong at the top of the ticket, it helps down ticket, obviously. Where he's not strong, it does not. But in places like Volusia County, as Chris pointed out, is really hot red right now. So I think it does help.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's come back inland, talk about Orange County. There's a few races that are quite interesting here. We've got Commission District 1, 3, and 5. Starting with District 1, Betsy Vandelay, Bobby Olszewski, and Niren Haider. Dick Batchelor, some big names in there. Who would you think might have the edge in this race?
Well, Betsy Vandelay has really gotten the endorsement of Scott Boyd, the incumbent county commissioner. She's got the endorsement of Commissioner Pete Clark and others. Bobby O, who we affectionately known as in West Orange County, has got the endorsement of the mayor of Apopka, some city commissioners, I don't like Oakland and Winter Garden. It's an interesting race because Betsy's raising a lot of money, but Bobby O is every place. I live out in that area, so I get the West Orange Times and the Southwest Bulletin, and I think he's into there about every single week. Walking door to door, whatever. So he's putting a lot of leather on the pavement out there. She might outraise him financially, looks like she is at this point in time, but it's a ground game, and he's working hard at it.
Yeah, I think when you look at this, every community that gets involved in politics are split. Dick was mentioning endorsements. You could kind of go to every business group that does endorsements, and half are with her, half are with him. To his point, Bobby is working the neighborhoods, and to a level I haven't seen in a while. I mean, if you're going to find him, you better go to that district because that's where he's at. She has gone negative, at least in mailers. I saw that last week, and that's usually an indication if you go negative that's because you think you have to. So that may be an indication that polling suggests Bobby's ground game is working. But there's two other candidates in the race, and you have to get 50% plus one. So that's going to be the real interesting thing here is can Bobby, which I think is probably leading at this point, does he have enough to get 50% plus one, or does he and Betsy go to a runoff in November when a whole new populist base is going to show up than a primary election? So the race almost resets. They both have to fundraise all over again. And it's really a whole new group of voters compared to a primary. So I know he is fundraising. I spoke with him actually last week on this. He's fundraising furiously trying to get a few more mailers out because he thinks he's got a shot to win it at the end of the month. But with two other candidates in there, and I know at least one of them is trying to get votes, that can be tricky for him.
Niren Haider, what do we know about that candidate?
She's from the community. I mean, obviously they all are, but she has roots there, and I'm on the Business Force board, and she came before the board. Now, she took a couple positions that I guess you could argue are anti-business, so it wasn't that hard for that group to make a decision not to endorse her, but very professional, easy to speak with. She didn't come off as the quote-unquote, I use the quotes there, crazy or anything like you meet sometimes, just very reasonable and wants to be a community advocate. And I think we told both Bobby and Betsy in that interview, whichever of you win, reach out to her and get her involved and stuff. Maybe put her on BZA or something because she obviously wants to be a good community advocate.
And you've got another candidate, Usha Jain, who is a doctor and has been in that community for like 30 years. So she has some name recognition, but it appears that she's self-funding, which is a very minimal amount of money. So I really don't see her getting any traction in that race.
Well, on to Orange County Commission, District 3, Pete Clark, the incumbent, but he does have some challenges there, including Bill Moore, former OPD officer. Chris, is Pete Clark on pretty solid ground here, though?
I think he is. He's been careful and measured about his votes he's taken the last 4 years. Doesn't necessarily always just go with the safe choice. He's not afraid to go on a ledge. But, you know, and met with his candidate, his one issue is policing. And I think someone said, well, why aren't you running for sheriff? Why are you running for county commission? And I think while maybe in the wake of the Pulse shooting, he may have got a little bump going door to door in the neighborhoods, I do think Pete has a solid ground game. He's fundraised just fine. He gets along with all his commissioners. It's hard for people to say something negative about Pete. So unless something dramatic happens in the next couple of weeks, I'd be shocked if Pete loses this race.
Pete's got involved in some issues like anti-trafficking issues, anti-fracking issues. He was a longtime employee of the county before he became county commissioner, so he understands how the process works very well. And his fundraising has come along fine. I think he's the one to beat. I think he's strong.
Orange County Commission District 5, this is an interesting race. Tim McKinney, Ted Edwards, they've been going kind of toe-to-toe there. Also got Emily Bonilla and Gregory Eisenberg. Dick Batchelor, what's going on here? What can you tell us about this race?
Tim McKinney, you need to watch him. You know, Tim started a global outreach, really kind of redeveloping all of Biflow. He's done a tremendous job out there, got a lot of exposure for it, a lot of good press for what he's done out there. And also, you had that major vote on the Lake Pickett project as far as going east of the Econ, as far as a major, major development. And he's been able to galvanize those people behind him. So that's a big issue. There are several thousands of people impacted by that. It's a single-member district. So Ted, and I know that Tim's walking doors. He's not raising the money. Of course, Ted Edwards is incumbent and haven't been there and done that before. He can raise a tremendous amount of money. But I would say if there's anything to watch in an unusual political year, could have Tim McKinney come out of the pack.
Mm-hmm. Chris, is development the big issue out in this part of the county, do you think?
If it wasn't, it is now. Mm-hmm. Lake Pickett North was a big vote. I think before that vote, and I don't fault the commissioner for how he voted. I know Ted well enough to know that he took everything into account and tried to make the best decision there. That's how he is. He's a very reasoned commissioner when he makes these votes. But there were a lot of people, if you watched that commission, and I don't think they were just random people. Those were neighborhood folks who had major issues with it. And with one of his candidates, Emily Bonilla, who's an environmentalist, has mm-hmm. a book called East of the Econ. She went after him. McKinney went after him. Eisenberg. That was pretty universal. I think before that vote, he probably had a really good shot of making it out of the primary, 50% plus one. And he still may. But I think McKinney, as Dick said, is a strong candidate, has good rapport in that community. And now this vote, which has gotten headlines, which has allowed his other candidates to kind of beat up on a little bit. It may weaken him a little bit and put him to the general election. And while he still should be fine in the general, the ball game changes because we are going to see an unprecedented election with who's on the top of the ballot in November.
Tim McKinney's come in for some flack himself, though, from some of the other challenges there.
Yeah, apparently how he's run his nonprofit and such has raised some issues, and they've as politics goes, it's your job to almost raise those if you know your opponent has some issues. So they've raised those, and I think that's probably hurt him a little bit. But again, Ted's the incumbent, Ted's the front runner. They're all aiming their arrows at him. And I think he still has a good shot of getting out in August 30th. But the most recent vote and the fact that, you know, they've dialed up their rhetoric, it may weaken him a little bit and keep him from getting 50% plus one.
Mm-hmm. And direct mail is what drives those campaigns, too. And they have single-member districts. So look out for what Ted's going to do. And if he kind of unleashes on Tim on the negative side with the direct mail, that can have a very substantial impact.
Well, let's turn to Seminole County. District 3, Lee Constantine, no challenges there.
No challenger.
Any surprises in that, Dick Batchelor?
Not really. You know, Lee's an interesting guy. Lee's been a city councilman. He's been a mayor. He's a member of the state house. He's a member of the state senate, and now he's a county commissioner. Loves public policy, been doing it a long time. And he's good at what he does. I mean, he is one of those, as a legislator, took on some very, very controversial, complex issues, likes to bring people together and negotiate things out. So I'm not surprised that he doesn't have an opponent. He's very strong.
Mm-hmm. District 5, Brenda Carey, Francis Coleman Oliver, and Alexander Duncan are the three people lining up for that race. Chris Carmody, this is kind of an interesting race. Francis Oliver, she was in the headlines a little bit a few years ago commenting on the Trayvon Martin case. Will people remember that, people who have been sort of following that?
I don't believe so. I think unless mailers can be sent out, I think this is Brenda's to lose. And I was just last week emceeing the Seminole County Hobnob, where, you know, all these candidates are. And typically only business folks show up to that and vote. There was a few close votes, like the clerk of court race up there is a very close race, and there's three competitive candidates. Both Brenda and Commissioner DeLauri, they were running away with it. And that's usually, it's anecdotal, but that's usually how I measure some of these things. If the new candidates don't have anyone talking, well, I know they're new, but they're really interesting or they're really motivated or this. I didn't hear any of that. And so I would be shocked if Commissioner Carey loses this. She's been an excellent commissioner, and she they run countywide every time, even though they have to live within their district. So she has name ID. It's not a matter of a new district or new this. Most of the voters in the county have been voting for her and will probably likely continue to vote for her.
And Bob Dulary, District 1 commissioner there.
I got the story here on his opponent because I was trying to figure out where Mr. Osborne came from.
Walter Osborne, this is.
Yes. And so apparently this is why these commissioners get so nervous on votes they take. There was a land issue over a permit at the, in a rural area, and Chairman Dulary made the motion to not approve what this gentleman was asking for. And literally 2 days later, he was filed and running against Chairman Dulary. So he hasn't raised a whole lot of money. I have not heard of any mailers up there. I don't even believe he showed up at the hobnob there either. So I think he's upset and that he has every right to be upset. You know, you don't get what you want. Free speech, First Amendment allows us to go out and make our case. But again, I'd be shocked if Chairman Dulary doesn't walk away with this.
Mm-hmm. Dick Batchelor, is Seminole County ever going to change from its fairly reliably kind of Republican roots?
That would be wishful thinking on my part, and I don't think it's going to happen.
We've been speaking to Dick Batchelor and Chris Carmody talking about some of the local political races here in Central Florida. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, best-selling author Kate DiCamillo revisits her past as a beauty pageant contestant in a sleepy Central Florida town in her latest novel. That's when Intersection returns. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. Kate DiCamillo is a Newbery Award-winning author. She's a finalist for the National Book Award. Her books include Because of Winn-Dixie, The Tale of Despero, and others. She has a new book out called Ramey Nightingale. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for talking with me about books.
So your latest work is set in Central Florida and tells the tale of 10-year-old Ramey Clark and her quest to win the Little Miss Central Florida Tire 1975 beauty pageant. What made you want to return to Central Florida as a setting for this novel?
The thing was, I didn't consciously think, oh, I'm going to go back to Florida. But I, well, the very first, where the story started for me was with the name of the contest. So Little Miss Central Florida Tire 1975. It made me laugh. And then I got Ramey's name. Most things start with names for me. And so, and then I quickly realized that she was not the kind of kid that would typically enter a contest like that. So then I'm like, why is she in that contest? And then I figured out why, because she's thinking if she wins it, then her father will see her picture in the paper and come home because he's recently left the family. So I kind of just backed into it step by step thinking, okay, I have this the name of the contest. I thought it was going to be just a funny book, a send-up about an inept child in a beauty contest. I was in the Little Miss Orange Blossom contest. My mom has passed away, so I can't ask her why she put me in that contest, because if there was anybody who should not have been in the Little Miss Orange Blossom contest, it was me. So I just, that whole idea of those kind of contests. And then I'm back home. I'm back, you know, I'm in Central Florida. And that's where I was a kid, is here. And so, and I'm tapping into that kid self. I grew up in a small town 30 miles west of Orlando called Claremont. And I've been in Minneapolis, Minnesota for 22 years now. But this is where I was a kid.
So you were in the Orange Blossom, Little Miss Orange Blossom?
And don't ask me what happened there, because time has drawn a merciful veil over the whole thing. I just have one very clear memory of standing on the stage thinking, wow, I shouldn't be here.
Was that your one and only experience?
And like I said, my mom's not around for me to ask her anymore why she would think that it would be a good idea to put a kid like me in a contest like that. I was the shyest kid in the world.
Is it something you've spent much time researching and thinking about for this book?
No, I didn't do any research at all other than pulling up those memories of what it felt like to be a kid, which are always very close to the surface for me. It's not a lot of work for me to find my 10-year-old self, and that's all the research I did, my 10-year-old heart.
Kate DiCamillo, this is a pretty serious theme for your book, 10-year-old child who is, you know, missing her father. How tough is it to write about that kind of thing?
As a kid whose father left the family when I was 6 years old, it was actually kind of a relief to deal with it directly. When I was a kid, and I don't know if it's this way now, but it was just, it wasn't talked about a lot. And that's one of the things that I love about what books can do, is it's a place for a kid to feel like they're not alone. Because I do think a lot of kids deal with a missing parent. And if they're not dealing with a missing parent, they're dealing with loss of one sort or another, because that's what it means to be in this world. So when you find a story where somebody has an ache or a sorrow that mirrors your own, it makes you feel less alone, I think.
Can I ask, did you ever reconnect with your father?
I have a PowerPoint presentation I do when I go and talk to kids in school. And I tell them, you know, that we moved to Central Florida from Philadelphia in 1969. And the plan was that my father was an orthodontist. He was going to sell his practice and move to Florida too. And he didn't. And it's not that I didn't see him again. He would visit. And sometimes we went to visit him, but he never lived with us again. And it was never something that I understood as a kid. Just didn't understand it. And you almost feel like for the adults, you have to pretend like it's not happening, you know. So it was a relief to confront it directly in this book.
When you were writing this book, were you kind of writing it for your 10-year-old self?
I think that you kind of write every story for yourself. There's this thing about how if the more specific I can make it to myself, the more universal it becomes. So I'm writing, and I'm not thinking about myself as much as I'm thinking about telling the story well and true. But I can see when I'm done how deeply personal it is, and that's only after it's done. Before that, I'm just like trying to tell the story in a way that makes sense to me.
So what did you write when you were a child and you were grappling with some of these big unanswerable questions?
It's funny because I didn't write. And I think that writing in the schools has changed quite a bit. I learned how to write an essay. That's what we were taught. There wasn't creative writing. And I was a kid who loved to read so much that I didn't even occur to me that human beings wrote books. To me, books were so wonderful. I don't know where I thought they came from, but I didn't make the connection that it was something that people do, which is something else that I talk about a lot to the kids when I go into schools. It's like, look at me. You know, I'm just a big mess of a person, and I get to do this thing, this amazing thing, tell stories for a living. So it's just like, you don't have to be somebody extraordinary to do this. You just have to be somebody who's willing to do the work.
So who did you read?
Every book I could get my hands on, I read. I read my way through the school library, the public library, a lot of books in our house. My mother was spectacular about buying me books, reading to me, taking me to the library. There was nothing that I didn't read, except for some reason there was no Roald Dahl in the public library or the school library. I missed all of Roald Dahl, so I've gone back and read that as an adult. I love it. Absolutely spectacular books. And I just was speaking, and somebody asked me after the speech, was there a book that you kept on coming back to as a kid and reading compulsively? And there were a couple, but for the most part, I needed every book I could get my hands on. It felt like a physical need. It's still that way, kind of.
I read that when you were growing up in Claremont, you spent so much time at the library, you basically got special privilege. They said you can take out whatever book you want for as long as you like.
It was a four-book maximum was the rule at the time that you could check out. And the librarian came up to another librarian that was checking me out and said, Kate may check out as many books as she likes at a time, the four-book maximum is waived for her because she is a true reader. So not only did I love that library and the books in it, but it was also a place where I felt seen, and it really mattered.
So this library was kind of a refuge for you. Do you get the sense that libraries these days are also refuges for kids who are like you growing up?
Absolutely. I think that libraries matter now more than ever, as safe places, as community places. And, you know, the great thing about walking into a public library, and this has happened to me so many times, is Librarians will get you whatever it is that you need. I need to find this, that. I need to, and they will find it for you. It is the most amazing thing in the world to think that no matter who you are, you can walk into a public library and get the book that you need.
So libraries these days, they're so high-tech compared to what they were 20, 30 years ago. I'm wondering if books are still able to compete with 3D printers, simulators, everything else you find in the modern library.
And you do find a lot of technological marvels in the public library. But every time, and I've been in libraries all over the country now, when I was ambassador for young people's literature, I did a ton of traveling and went into a lot of libraries. There's always a kid in there curled up in a corner reading a book. I think in a way, books, physical books matter even more now. There's so much comfort in holding the physical book.
Are you finding that kids are reading as much these days as they would have when you were growing up?
Yes, and you know, it's funny because people are worried. They think that kids are just on devices and playing video games. I have connected with so many kids who are passionate about reading and books that I actually feel very hopeful about the book and a child's connection to the book and how much it matters. So I just have seen so much that has been truly moving. Kids clutching books, literally. Holding books like they're precious objects. So
you get some feedback from readers, I'm sure. What have readers been telling you about Raimi Nightingale?
I've had a lot of adults who have responded to the book telling me about how their parents left when they were kids. And I have had kids who have told me, it's funny because adults are always thinking that books are too dark for kids. Kids tell me how funny they think this book is. One kid told me it was like being on a roller coaster at the fair. She was a little bit afraid because she didn't know how it was going to turn out, but as soon as it was done, she wanted to get back on the roller coaster, and I thought that was the best thing that anybody had said to me.
Is there anything you can't write about? I mean, you talk about tackling some pretty dark themes, even like, you know, The Tale of Despero, that's about exile, and there's some terror in there. It's kind of a scary book, but is there anything you won't tackle?
I will always try to tell the story as truthfully as I can, so it's what the story needs. And so I don't, like with Raimi, I didn't set out to tell the story of a child whose father has left. It just kind of evolved. And it's so it's whatever the story needs, and there's nothing that I would shy away from. But I always want to have that balance of light and dark, because there are both things in this world, and there's so much that's beautiful and joyful, and there are hard things too, and I want that balance in the story.
I want to just come back to Central Florida and looking at it from somebody who's been away for a while. Do you recognize the Central Florida of your childhood?
I just said to the guy who drove me from the airport, he said, "It first time in Orlando?" And I said, we were just driving away from the airport. I said, "When I'm from here, and I remember when the airport was a little building and you would walk out onto the tarmac to." So I said, "No, it's not my first time, but everywhere I look, I see something that makes me remember, and also something that I don't." So it's surreal almost, because so much of it is in my heart, and so much of it is so different. And like where I grew up in Claremont, it was all citrus groves, and those are all gone now.
Do you think you'll return to Central Florida as thematic material or inspiration for future books?
Perhaps. My heart is always here, so.
Kate DiCamillo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.